Hey y'all, how's it going? That was old news, wasn't it? I thought it was. Man, government shutdown, were they going to have another one of those? And then, did he say last week's attack at the mall in Kenya or last month? Alan, you sent me old news to play, man. I'm the one who played it, but I didn't know. Well, I don't know. Maybe you'll hear old news in the next hour break, too. I almost interrupted it and just started my own complaining right then. But, oh well, I don't know. So, now you know what was the news, what, last summer or something? All right. Well, it was a mess up, but it wasn't mine, so I ain't care. All right. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Today on the show, Greg Mitchell will be on to talk about long-lost footage of the American nuclear massacre in Japan back in 1945. Oh, yeah, they got it in full color chrome Technicolor. Are those the same thing? Or those are two different kinds of things? Anyway, yeah. They lied. They covered up. They didn't want the people to know the truth about what they had done. Because they felt guilty. I mean, not Truman, but pretty much the rest of them. And because they wanted to build more nukes. Bigger, worse nukes. So they could do it some more. And they were worried that if the American people knew the truth, then they would stop them. Yeah, fat chance. Slim chance. Wait. Yeah, both. Anyway, it wasn't an issue, because they covered it up. They hid all the footage, and they didn't show it to people, and they lied. Oh, man, how they lied. It's almost hilarious how they lied. Anyway, good old Greg Mitchell, he'll be back on the show. For some reason over there at Who, What, Why, they just couldn't wait till August to run this series. So, okay, fine with me. Always take an opportunity to interview Greg Mitchell about Nuke in Japan if I can, you know. He's really good on it. He's written 3 or 4 books now on it. So anyway, that'll be good. And then I promised you yesterday that today I would play for you this interview that I recorded with Robert Blum. And it took me forever to find the time to sit down and edit this thing. And it needed a good edit because I had screwed it up. But anyway, so that's going to happen today too. And Robert Blumen, good friend of the show, and among the best of the Austrian school economists. He was the first Austrian school economist to say, hey guys, it looks like a housing bubble, which would have been back in 2004. Now, there were plenty of Austrians, including Ron Paul, who had predicted the housing bubble. You know what you're going to do. You're going to create a housing bubble. Well, Robert Blumen was the first one. He said, hey, guys, look at these prices. Looks like a bubble to me. And then Mark Thornton and the rest of those guys picked it up from there. And if you're listening to the Austrians, then you didn't lose everything in that mess. If you weren't, you very well might have. Yeah. Those idiots at FSN, they need to be fired. They do such a terrible job. I wonder if Jason's going to email them or whether I should. You guys sent us news from last year, you idiots. You know, when I don't have to correct all their levels for them. Which, they're finally getting that straight since I screamed at them. Hey, do you think you guys could have the voices of your different news readers within, I don't know, say 25 decibels of each other? You know, within some sort of range. They finally started working on that, and then they sent us news from last year. All right, good. You guys really suck at this. It'd be better off just if we played Fox, because at least it's hilarious. And you know that the production values are high, even though the way they talk is really funny. and the things that they say aren't true. Still, but can't get ABC News, CBS News, whatever. Isn't there 1,000 different generic top-of-the-hour newses to play? It's these FSN guys. You know, on the other hand, I like the fact that they're British because that means they don't talk about American pop stars. I just hate that stuff. It's like a fly while I'm eating. It's just, it's a pet peeve of mine. I don't want to know anything about these people at all. Leave me alone. And pop star news, I just can't deal. And so if you have some kind of British pseudo wannabe BBC news like we were playing here, then it's pretty good at excluding that stuff. Not completely. Sometimes American pop stars make international news, you know, if they run a stop sign or have a breakup with their boyfriend or something. But most of the time, we don't have to hear it, you know, so that's one advantage. Maybe we can just get BBC top-of-the-hour news. Can we do that? Do they have just top-of-the-hour AM format, 6 minutes? I wonder if the second hour... Hey, Jason, can you check and see if the second hour is also old news? Before I play it? At least I could play yesterday's news. Would be better than playing news from last summer. Or I don't know. Maybe people want to remember last summer. When was that mall attack anyway? For some reason, I don't remember what month that was in. It should have got thumbtacked in my brain onto the calendar where it belongs, but I missed it. All right, I got to Google that right now. Mall attack in Kenya was one day ago. No. September 2013. The end of last summer. So I guess not long after Obama backed down on the Syria war. Okay, that's how I'll remember that. All right. By the way, speaking of which, there's this ridiculous article in Rolling Stone today about what a peacenik Obama is. And the truth is, I sort of kind of agree with the premise that Obama didn't really want to do a war in Syria. Now, I think the American people were the ones who stopped him. I think he was going to do it anyway. It was the American people who stopped him. But then, as they admit in the article, they're trying to make it sound like, oh, Barack Obama took on the warfare state and won. The war machine tried to make him do it, but he heroically resisted and all this. But then they admit at the top of the second page of the article that the chiefs were against it. In fact, Ray McGovern told the story about how Chairman Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that he told the reporters, I couldn't justify it. I don't know what they're going to do up there, man, but I told them not to, kind of thing. And that he... Or at least he had hinted like that towards some reporters. And he told Obama that, and he made it known, I guess was what it was. He made it known that he had told Obama that, I can't back you up on this, man. It's the wrong thing to do. So, if anything, Obama was the war machine, and it was the military who stopped him. Because they didn't want, you know, there's no end game to it. Escalation dominance, right? That's what Gareth Porter calls it. The military doesn't want to get in a fight unless they can bet that they're going to win every single exchange on the board. And any escalation will be because they wanted to escalate, and they know that however they do escalate, that they'll win that way too. Otherwise, they don't want to fight. They don't, you know, pick on anybody their own size if they can help it. But anyway, I just thought that was funny that, yeah, Obama, the heroic peacenik president who doubled the war in Afghanistan out of cowardice. We all know that he knew better, but he did it anyway because he was too much of a coward to take on David Petraeus, his subordinate, politically. He was too afraid to tell the American people that this general's out of line. He wants to double down the war, but he admits, even in private, that it's not going to work anyway. And so, no, we're done. He could have won that fight, but he didn't. Instead, he doubled the war in Afghanistan. He expanded the war to Pakistan and to Yemen. And he continued Bush's slaughter in Somalia, spread the war onto Libya, and has been backing in Libya and especially in Syria, has been backing the Mujahideen there. And, you know, they also sort of kind of half correctly say in the article that he's resisted full scale backing of the Mujahideen there. Yeah, but he's been backing the Free Syrian Army, and all their stuff fell into the hands of the Mujahideen, so it's the same thing. And he's been working with the Saudis and the Qataris to back the Mujahideen all along. CIA's been helping coordinate all that all along. And by the way, you know, if America has Israel sell TOW missiles to the Ayatollah, we don't say that that's not Reagan's fault. We just say that that's, you know, failed plausible deniability, using the Israelis as cutouts. It's the same thing as using the Saudis to do the dirtiest of the dirty work here. It's still America's war. Think anybody else in the world is confused by that? At least he didn't carpet bomb them. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Look, it's just a little bit of an Ebola outbreak. It's probably not that big of a deal, right? According to TV, just now, 76 people have died in the latest Ebola outbreak in Guinea. And it's there are a couple cases in Liberia and somewhere else, I forgot. Bad times. Here's what you're going to want to do. You're going to want to avoid catching Ebola. If you can. Sound advice. From me to you. There you go. You don't want that stuff. All right. So, check out all the news I have to cover on the show today. CIA misled on interrogation program, Senate report says. So, Greg Miller has seen some of it. And I guess, just to the summary, I think the summary, or maybe the whole report. Maybe this is just their first take on it. Anyway, Washington Post, Greg Miller, top headline today at antiwar.com. And the big stories out of here is how they lied over and over again to the Congress and to the American people about how useful the CIA program was, how they lied and pretended that information that the FBI got by asking questions came from their torture when they didn't have anything to show for it. It's not in here, but we already know, especially because of Jonathan Landay's great work for McClatchy Newspapers, but others have covered this as well. How most of the torture was about trying to coerce Al-Qaeda guys, or at least assumed Al-Qaeda guys, into pointing the finger at Saddam Hussein. Like Sheikh Al-Libi, who was tortured into accusing Saddam Hussein of training Al-Qaeda warrior dudes, terrorists, how to hijack airplanes and how to make chemical weapons. Well, it wasn't true at all. There was a facility with an airplane, which, you know, leading the witness and everything, they had told him that. Giving him all the information he needed to build a story out of it. Of course, the airplane fuselage training ground was there so that anti-terrorist teams could practice taking back a hijacked airplane. Not to train terrorists how to hijack it. But anyway, Al-Libi figured out he could make the pain stop if he implicated Saddam Hussein. So he did. And then later on, George W. Bush had Gaddafi murder the guy in his prison cell and call it a suicide. Which that was when Gaddafi was America's friend again before he got stabbed in the back. You know, when he was an enemy, he survived for 20 years. He became friends with America again, survived 10. Anyway, murdered al-Libi because he knew too much, of course. And then, Cheney said he'd do it again. Of course, yeah, of course he would. I sure would like to see this whole report end up in Marcy Wheeler's hands here before too long so that we can find out what's really in this thing. That lady, man, she's got X-ray eyes, dude. She just gets right to the bottom of stuff immediately. And, one of the stories in here that was important, I guess, especially for the public's understanding of this, because of the movie Zero Dark Thirty, they made it look like the information of al-Kuwaiti, the courier, to bin Laden's hideout was tortured out of a guy. Or at least, you know, they, because of the confusion of the torture or whatever was it, the way they spun it in the movie. And anyway, no, that wasn't true at all. And that's completely debunked by the Senate report. And I usually don't take Dianne Feinstein's word for stuff, but yeah, when she's debunking torture claims of the Republicans, you can pretty much bank on it. And they go through this too. They also talk about not the official waterboarding you've heard about, but other people being dunked in frozen, freezing cold water and being soaked and sprayed with freezing cold water. And at the Salt Pit Torture Dungeon near Kabul. Isn't that a great name for a CIA torture dungeon? The Salt Pit. Yeah, okay, that sounds about right. Beating him repeatedly with a truncheon and smashing his head into a wall. They completely exaggerated the roles of Abu Zubaydah, and even al-Nashiri, it says here. It talks about the black sites in Romania and Poland. And anyway, so this is just the tip of the iceberg of what we know in here. Of course, at least one guy was murdered by the CIA at the Salt Pit. But, you know, again, and I should always mention this, I try to always mention this anytime we talk about the torture program. What Bush did is he didn't just authorize the CIA to use these tortures on al-Qaeda guys that they had captured or people they thought were al-Qaeda even, that they captured. What they did was they repealed even the idea that the Geneva Convention applied to America's wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, or anyone who happened to be held at Guantanamo Bay, for example. And so then these rules of, CIA interrogation techniques, etc., all filtered all the way down to the lowest specialist fighting the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they tortured tens of thousands of people. It wasn't just Abu Ghraib. It was at all of the prisons and all over the country and on the side of the road, in their houses, in front of their kids. These are the words of Tony Lugaranis, who was a torturer himself and admitted it and told the whole story to Frontline PBS. You can watch the video online right now at the Frontline website. Tony Lugaranis is his name. And he goes, man, we were torturing them everywhere, and it wasn't just us. It was completely widespread. Geneva Conventions don't apply to anyone who resists us, because anyone who resists us is a terrorist. And so we can do whatever we want with them, and et cetera, like that. Colonel Fishback talked about how a PUC, a person under control, the acronym became PUC. And then so, but what does that mean eventually? It's like, it's the N-word, right? It means they're not a human. You can do whatever you want with them. So I'm going to go smoke a PUC, man. I'm going to go tie one up and kick him like a heavy bag. And anyway, and this went on and on and on, tens of thousands of Iraqis especially, but Afghans too, suffered tortures at the hands of the American military. So the CIA thing is just, that was the real kind of, you know, program that created the situation at the top. But then, well, it all kind of spun out from there, I guess is a good way to say it. So anyway, just so you know, and no one has been held accountable whatsoever. When the Obama administration came into power, Obama said, we're going to look forward, not backwards, which has never worked for any criminal defendant in American history before, by the way. Not that I've ever heard of. Well, not who had less than $1 billion in his bank account. And they made an exception. They said, you know what? We're going to have a special investigator from the Justice Department is going to do a preliminary investigation to see whether there should be an investigation into whether they should pursue charges in two cases of CIA torturing people to death. And I don't know if they ever really proved that those were the only people who were tortured to death by the CIA. I tend to doubt that. But they were going to see if perhaps they would pursue an investigation into whether they should pursue charges in two cases of CIA murder, and they decided no. They will not pursue even the investigation into it. And so that was that. And everybody got away with it. And never mind that. Everyone knows. Hell, it was in ABC News and they didn't even deny it. They didn't even try. That the entire cabinet, that Bush, the president, signed off on this, and the entire cabinet, national security level guys, I'm not saying the Department of the Interior, but the vice president, the secretary of defense, the secretary of state, the national security advisor, her deputy, the director of central intelligence, the attorney general of the United States, they all met in the White House and choreographed the torture of Al-Qahtani down at Guantanamo Bay and more. And they all signed off on all the rest too. And all their lawyers, which means Haynes and Feith at the Pentagon, it means Addington and Libby. Was Libby one of the lawyers in the vice? Certainly Addington in the vice president's office. And then John Yoo in the White House. And then Judge Bybee and now Judge Bybee, Jay Bybee, and I forget who all at the Department of Justice. And anyway, there's a whole torture team. That's a Philip Sands book, The Torture Team. All the lawyers who conspired to pretend like there were loopholes in the torture statutes that you could drive a Bush torture program through. And as the other Scott Horton has explained on the show, the former chair of the New York Bar Association's committees on international law and on human rights, he explained over and over again on this show and others of mine in the past and in writing all over the place about how the U.S. government, this very same Justice Department, whose lawyers allowed all of this, they prosecute lawyers all the time for being, you know, the way they call them, mob lawyers, where these guys are actually so corrupt, they're not defending their clients. They're helping their clients break the law. They're explaining to helping conspire with their clients to get around the law, to evade the law in order to be able to continue to commit their crimes. And boy, there ain't no exception for lawyers that the U.S. Justice Department has ever heard of when it comes to that kind of thing. They nail lawyers to the wall all the time for that exact same kind of stuff. Trying to pretend that torture only means if the pain is equivalent to organ failure. Well, who says? These guys. They just made that up. Right? They even say in there, listen, we know, this is in the torture memos, we know that if you kill somebody, if you torture them to death, that you are still, this is like instructions to the CIA, you are still trying to prevent a greater harm from an Al-Qaeda attack on the American people, and so, therefore, don't worry about it. We got your back. You're covered. And no accountability whatsoever. Because of stuff like that. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom. featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Well, let me tell you about Greg Mitchell, all right? Greg Mitchell, he used to be the editor of Editor and Publisher, and right now he writes for The Nation magazine, and he keeps a blog at gregmitchellwriter.blogspot.com. It's called Pressing Issues. Lots of great stuff there. But then, here's the real deal, is he's written a ton of books, including The Age of WikiLeaks, Dead Reckoning, Executions in America, The Campaign of the Century, let's see here, Hiroshima in America, So Wrong for So Long, Atomic Cover-Up, and wait, there's one more, Hollywood Bomb, The Unmaking of the Most Important Movie Ever Made, and yeah, it goes on like that, but especially I wanted to make sure and emphasize the ones discussing nuclear weapons, the use, American use of nuclear weapons at the end of World War II. And then, so now he's got this series here at whowhatwhy.com. Well, I want to know where and when, too. But anyway, whowhatwhy.com, it's, well, it starts with how bombing Hiroshima got a Hollywood makeover, although that's kind of separate. Then there's a three-part series about the hiding of the documentary films. All four articles here at Who, What, Why are really great and worth your time. I hope you'll go look at them. They're not too long either or anything. You can go check them out and like them. Welcome back to the show, Greg. How are you doing?
Always happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here, and I really appreciate your attention to this subject because it'll never not be important. So, first of all, let's talk about how bombing Hiroshima got a Hollywood makeover because, as you kind of imply in some of the other ones, this is a big part of... you know, how history unfolded after the war,
right.
Starting with the revision halfway through the making of this MGM film, The Beginning or The End.
Right. Yeah, it came out of the idea from the atomic scientists who turned against the bomb after it was used on civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And MGM bought it and was in the early stages of the scripts was planning to make what might be called an anti-bomb epic. It kind of showed the Hiroshima bombing in a bad light and gave warnings about the development of bigger and better bombs. But halfway through, sort of the Pentagon got to them, and then the Truman White House got to them, revised the script, pictured Truman himself, able to get the actor playing him fired, was unhappy with even the actor, let alone the script. And so the movie ended up as kind of a goofy, tribute to the bomb, melodrama, and what was seen to be, and it was really the first and only epic about the bomb coming from MGM, could have had a big impact. And as you mentioned, I told the full story in my book, Hollywood Bomb, mm-hmm. but it was also the first part of, you'll find it at the Who, What, Why, sort of a separate article from the three-part series that you mentioned.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to go to the Pirate Bay right now and see if I can get it, because it was released, right?
Yeah, it's shown on via Turner Classics at times. I'm not sure if it's on DVD, but it shows up on TV from time to time. It was a Hollywood drama. It's not a documentary. So it didn't do well at the box office, which I guess was probably a good thing.
Right. Yeah, I was actually happy when I saw... 1947. Here it is. It's got no seeds. there's one torrent file, but it's got no seeds. Anyway, well,
okay.
Let's see if we can find it somewhere online. Oh, hell, I forgot what I was going to say now. I got distracted by my lousy Pirate Bay results here. Let's talk about some of the revisions then? You say they started out and they were, was it just the script or they had already begun shooting and they were sent back to go and take out everything realistic?
Yeah. They had the script circulated. There was even Ayn Rand had worked on a script for another studio, and then they didn't want to have two movies going, so they kind of incorporated some of her stuff. That's all in my book as well. And they, you know, it was a combination of editing the script, and then even after it was shot, they had a screening in Washington for the White House and other officials just before its release, and even as late as just, you know, a couple months before it was to be released, you know, the White House and other people saw this and were just objected to the way it portrayed Truman sort of making his decision to use the bomb, and they wanted it to underline all the, you know, all the reasons we've heard since about saving American lives, and we had no choice, and Japanese were never going to surrender, and it, you know, it saved a million American lives, and so forth. So they were rewriting right up to the end, and like I said, they got the actor playing Truman fired. They didn't like his attitude, so they got another actor in who portrayed Truman in a more godlike way.
That was funny. Yeah, you said, I love the way you write in here, the actor wrote some kind of smart aleck message back to the White House and said, well, hey, posterity's not going to be kinder to you than me, so you might as well suck it up there, Mr. Commander-in-Chief. I like that.
Yeah, it was sort of a classic to write that to Truman. And Truman didn't really get it. Truman thought it was the guy was writing a nice note to him and everything. He didn't get the sarcasm in it.
Yeah, well, anyway, we won't go too far off about Harry Truman, or we'll have to talk about the Ku Klux Klan and all of that. But anyway, so you know, I think it's really important the way you talk about in here. You go down the list of the suppression of facts and the fabrications, the things that were added, especially things like. The B-29s were pelted with heavy flak and made their act of nuking this peaceful, demilitarized city full of women and children into some heroic act of self-defense. And it just goes to show, really, when you go through this list here all together the way you do in kind of bullet point format, just how guilty their conscience was, or at least, how afraid they were of some level of accountability if people really knew the truth about what it was that they had done.
Well, I've always felt, two things. I've written about this for over 30 years now, and what's always driven me are two things. One, if we had nothing to be ashamed about, if this was such a slam dunk and right decision, you know, why have the government gone and the media gone to such an extent for decades to kind of cover up the full story? So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, we still have first strike weapons. And, you know, some people like to say, never again, and, you know, whatever happened the first time, we'll never use them again. We should never use them again. But that's undercut by the fact that we continually defend the use of them the first time, and we still have first strike weapons. So if you can defend the use against Japan, which was a, you know, somewhat unique, at least up to that period, situation, if you can continue to defend that and also Nagasaki, which was even worse, surely you can defend using it today. There's that precedent. So those are the two things that have driven me. You know, you mentioned I did write a book with Robert J. Lifton, Hiroshima and America, and then more on the subject of these films, I wrote a book called Atomic Cover-Up, which really tackles the you know, the story you just mentioned, plus the documentary films that I wrote about again this week. But Atomic Cover-Up is really about that film footage.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I think it was you probably that pointed me toward George Weller and his work, first into Nagasaki. And I interviewed his son all about it and all that kind of thing. And that's just another part of the story of the lengths that they went to suppress this information. And, you know, it's funny
from the get-go. I was a kid
in the Reagan years, after detente and when it was brinksmanship again, kind of Cold War years, and the hippies put The Day After on TV. I mean, I saw that when I was in, I don't know, what, third, fourth grade, something like that. So I think I kind of grew up with a whole different idea about what a nuclear war might look like than you know, the Americans who had come before me, who really didn't have much of a picture of Hiroshima other than a real faraway shot of a mushroom cloud, and that was about all they knew of it.
Right. Well, that's the story of the documentary footage, is really how these the American military elite film crew, you know, went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings and shot in color film, which was very unusual at the time, sort of the stark effects on people. You know, we had seen the black and white photos of the A-bomb dome and, you know, the rubble and all that kind of stuff, but we hadn't seen really even black and white photos, and here these guys have had color footage of the effects on people, the people dying of radiation disease, the terrible burns, so on and so forth, and the fact that when you look carefully, you said, gee, 9 out of 10 of these people are women and children, which we also wanted to obscure. We wanted people to think we bombed, you know, military base or, you know, they're at least men in factories, you know, as opposed to women and children. So that footage was, of course, quite stark, and really the story I tell is how that footage was suppressed for literally for decades, and really only, you know, came out, you know, started coming out about 20 years ago, and, you know, why it was suppressed and how it was suppressed, and also footage shot by Japanese newsreel team was confiscated by the U.S., and that was suppressed for decades.
Right. Now, when we come back, I want to give you a chance to really talk about the stories of the suppression of those films and what's in them and all that, but I can't help but make sure before we go out to this break to point out, as I don't know why I'm not smart enough, Greg, to think of this myself. For whatever reason, I had to plagiarize this from the great historian Ralph Raico. But Ralph Raico said, you know what, let's go ahead and give them their numbers. Oh, yeah, 500,000 American soldiers would have died if they'd had to invade Japan or whatever. Well, never even mind. Just take it for granted the condition of unconditional surrender. And just take for granted their numbers of how many soldiers, GIs, would have died in trying to invade Japan. Are you saying that if they had somehow been able to just send a force in to round up the women and children, the men, women, and children of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and just machine gun them all in the town square like the German Gestapo, that in order to end the war, that would have been okay? Because that wasn't American rules of engagement in Europe whatsoever. Is that what would be all right? Would be to round them all up and machine gun them all to death? Or for some reason it's okay if you blast them all to kingdom come in a moment with some fission? Somehow that's like painless or more justifiable or allowable. But of course, when you put it that way, then the answer has to be absolutely not, that Truman was as bad as a Nazi to do what he did.
Yeah, well, briefly, I know you want to go to a break, is one of the real turning points for me in this whole subject was when I went to Hiroshima in 1984, and first day I was there, I was taken up to a hill to overlook.
Real quick, go ahead. You got 30 seconds.
Go on. I'll come back later. It's okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a hard break, man. I can't help it. All right, hold it right there, everybody. It's the great Greg Mitchell. And we're talking about his series at whowhatwhy.com about the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We'll be right back after this. Oh, follow him on Twitter, Greg Mitch. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Greg Mitchell. He wrote this 3-part series, plus one about a movie, too. A Hollywood movie. They're all about the suppression of the film evidence of the American nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. in August of 1945. And I'm sorry about that break there, Greg. You were saying what?
Okay, well, just quickly, my first day in Hiroshima, I was taken up on this hill to look out over the city, the modern city, get a little sense of geography there. And you saw this enormous city as it was in 1945 in this dome, surrounded by hills on three sides. And it was very easy to then look out and imagine this new weapon being detonated right in the center above that city in this, like, the top of a dome. And with the hills around it, and even before the attack, one of the reasons for attacking Hiroshima was that these hills would create a focusing effect, as they put it, which would direct the power of the bomb back on the city for greater extermination. And you know, it was just easy, that image of looking out and saying someone deliberately set off a weapon deliberately at the center of this, over the center of the city, to kill everyone within this, from one hill to another, you know, deliberately. And so that kind of is an image you kind of sticks with you. And that partly inspired the work I've done since then.
Yeah, well, Truman himself was asked at one point years later, well, why didn't you nuke three cities or something? Because it took them one extra day to surrender, I guess. And he said, well, you know, we considered it, but the thought of all those women and babies. So at the end of the day, he really was willing to admit that, yeah, he had murdered hundreds of thousands of women and babies. And it was, but, you know, a few hundred thousand more of them, why, that was just too much, you know?
Well, that was, you know, the footage that we talked about that was suppressed afterwards. This was, I mean, I talked to both the director of that, the U.S. military project, and sort of his chief staffer on it. I interviewed both of them, and they, you know, they both said that basically, contrary to what many people are told, a lot of the people in the running the U.S. military, running the top officials in the U.S. did feel guilty about it, did realize perhaps in retrospect that this possibly could have been avoided. And so they wanted to hide this, and they wanted to hide the fact that we wanted to build a bigger bomb, which we did, with the hydrogen bomb. We wanted to test these weapons in the Pacific and then in the U.S., and of course, growing up in the 50s and 60s, I was subjected to fallout like everyone else. So they had to kind of sell the bomb. They had to sell bigger and better bombs. They had to sell the testing of the bomb. They had to sell the getting an arsenal in the tens of thousands for, you know, to going forward. So there was a lot of reasons to try to make Hiroshima and Nagasaki go away, or at least seem like a cut and dried, slam dunk kind of decision. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you talk about, and it's believable to me, certainly because of the lack of contrary information coming out, that even though so few people saw that original Hollywood movie about it, that more or less became the official history anyway. All the tropes about just how desperate and necessary it was and all of that. There really was no competing information out there, right? Like, I don't know, maybe if you asked a commie or something, actual pro-Soviet or something. Other than that, there was no contrary information for anybody to really complain about.
Well, that's right. I mean, in my atomic cover-up book, I talk about how it wasn't just films; they also suppressed photographs. Even in Japan, they didn't have access to photographs about what happened to them until the late 1970s. They, you know, started a nationwide movement to raise money to buy photos and some of this film footage from the National Archives in the U.S. And they published big books and so forth. But until the late 1970s, the Japanese themselves had very little photographic record of what had happened, because the photos and the negatives and the film footage were all seized by the U.S. and disappeared.
All right. Now, I guess now only some of this has been released, but never just the reels of all the raw footage of the color and the black and white, right? Just little pieces.
Well,
here
they're now declassified. They're at the National Archives in Maryland. People have had access. Really, the filmmakers didn't really know about it till when I was editor of Nuclear Times in the early 1980s. The first feature I assigned was on this subject, And then filmmakers started flooding the National Archives with requests. Really, it was not hardly anyone knew this footage existed until then. And so over the years, bits and pieces, small amounts of footage. I've even worked on a film that used some of the footage. But there's never been a full documentary on the story. I'd be happy to participate if anyone wants to do that. There's never been a full documentary on kind of the story behind the story of this footage. There's never been a full documentary airing, you know, large parts of the footage. So that's still yet to be done. But you know, small bits of this color footage have shown up in different films, and you know, maybe even some of the listeners have seen it. Any color footage of the aftermath of the atomic bomb or the victims has to have come from this footage. Mm-hmm. It's the only record of it, and it was the only thing in color.
And now, is this the one that was hidden in the ceiling?
Well, that was the Japanese newsreel teams had shot footage even before the Americans got there, and
so that was the black and white footage that ended up becoming the movie Hiroshima and Nagasaki 1945.
Right, and they were forced to turn over.
I have trouble keeping track of which footage is which.
Right, they were forced to turn over the footage, but they made a copy and kept the copy or part of it, I guess a small part of it, in a ceiling. And then years later, they dug that out and were able to look at some of that. But that was just a small part of what they had.
And can you tell us the story of this guy Sussan, Herbert Sussan?
Yeah, he was sort of the person who got me involved in this again over 30 years ago. He, you know, he was one of the chief people on the U.S. military team. He came back from the war, became a pioneering director, producer, and director at CBS in the early days of television, and he was haunted by what he'd seen. And he wanted to get this footage out. And he approached everyone from Bob Truman himself to Bobby Kennedy to Edward R. Murrow to try to get this footage shown on TV or made into movies or whatever. And he couldn't, they wouldn't even help him find it. You know, it was a great mystery what had happened to it. And so he tried for decades. And then he's the one who happened to run into the Japanese activist at the UN in the late 1970s at an exhibit of some of the stills from the film, and he said, "You know what? I shot some of that footage." And so the Japanese then discovered, "Oh, this film exists out here," and he led them then to the film at the National Archives, and sort of the rest is history. But he was sort of the key person. He then died a few years later from lymphoma, which some people have connected to exposure to radiation in the atomic cities.
Oh man! So now on this series again, it's a three-part series at Who, What, Why, by Greg Mitchell here, and you have some of the color footage, and I think you have also YouTube of. Oh no, it's just a bit. I'm sorry. I thought it was the whole thing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 1945. Do you know where people can find at least, you know, the best versions, longest versions of all these online anywhere?
Well, you know, if you go to, I mean, first of all, I have a trailer for my book. If you just put an atomic cover-up at YouTube, this mm-hmm. will come up as the first thing. It's been quite popular. It shows some of the color footage. So in two or three minutes, you'll get to see what we're talking about here. So if you just search atomic cover-up at YouTube, you will find that. If you put in Hiroshima color footage at YouTube, you'll find at least one and possibly more 8 or 9 minute excerpts from the original footage. So you get to see it at length. It's a very small part of it. If you put in Hiroshima Nagasaki 1945, you can find the full version of the 15-minute film that was eventually made by Eric Barnow around 1970. Oh. From the Japanese footage. So there are ways to see parts of this. You know, YouTube is your friend. So that's what I'd recommend. The Who, What, Why series has a couple videos embedded in that with the stories also.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember now because I have a little documentary section on my own website where I've been trying to collect some of these. And I have something, maybe one or two things. Pardon me. I think about the radiation sickness, but I don't remember the title off the top of my head. I'm kind of furiously paging through now trying to find it here. But you're right about YouTube is, well, it can be pretty ruthless and kicking people off there sometimes, but you're right. It's very useful, and pretty much anything can be found on there one way or the other.
There's even on YouTube, just quickly, there's one of the things that internally the Pentagon did was they made a couple training films. They took some of the footage, black and white footage, and made these training films to show to soldiers who were going to march under the mushroom cloud and in our tests in Nevada. So it wasn't to warn people about radiation or the bomb. It was to prepare our soldiers for going to war with the bomb. So you can find at least one of them on YouTube, but they were not released to the public. Those were strictly for the military.
Yeah, I saw one where they're standing right under air-to-air nuclear missile that was to be used against Russian bombers, and they're standing right under it, bragging about how great it is. Anyway, I'm sorry we're all out of time. Thanks so much, Greg Mitchell, whowhatwhy.com, everybody, and the nation. Thanks, Greg.
Bye.
Hey, I'll Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Well, is this show still on? Oh, okay, good. Well, all right. I guess I'm the one hosting it. I better say something. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the show today. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org, and I'm on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Is that an echo? Or a bird outside? That also said show, same time as me, right after. Yeah, I don't know. All right, welcome to the show. I'm Scott. I better hurry up and say a bunch of stuff because I got a bunch of stuff to say. First of all, if you happen to live in the Bay Area and you're listening to me right now on the internet, I need you to know the truth that tomorrow Gareth Porter is going to be giving a talk at 7 p.m. at the World Affairs Council. Wherever that is, you're going to have to Google it. At 7 o'clock tomorrow at the World Affairs Council. And I think that's in San Francisco. That's what my brain says. Another part of my brain is not sure if it agrees or not. But Google it anyway. The World Affairs Council. Yeah, this sounds like a San Francisco thing. World Affairs Council tomorrow at 7. And then with Peter Collins, the radio show host, at Wesley Hall in San Rafael. That's on the 3rd, and that's at 7:30, and then on the 4th, he'll be at the Berkeley Fellowship Unitarian University. That's in Berkeley, California, so three of them coming up. Maybe I'll try to tweet that or something so that there's something that somebody can link to. I don't really, have anything to do with it other than I would like for Gareth Porter's book to become a really big deal. I want it to be news. I want Gareth Porter's book to be news. A new book out early this year says that this is all a bunch of crap that we've been shoveling all this time, and that actually the truth is Iran was never making nuclear bombs. in the first place. It was all lies told by the governments, which are liars. And then that way, it seems like in that atmosphere, it would be easier to go ahead and get the nuclear deal through. Well, you know, we're all kind of admitting now that we sort of been pretending that there was a problem this whole time. There really wasn't. So, well, come on. Get along. And then we'll all be rubbing butts in fields of flowers and it'll be perfect, right? That's what I think. So go and see Gareth Porter give a talk. If you live within shooting distance of the Bay Area. It's a pretty big bay, so there's a pretty big area around it. So that's a pretty wide swath of the population. Go and listen to Gareth talk and buy his book. In fact, buy boxes full of his book and then give them to other people. Right? Why not? Support. Gareth Porter rules. You know it. I mean, if you've ever heard this show more than three or four times, you know Gareth Porter is awesome. Right? So, the book is Manufactured Crisis. The talk is about how manufactured the crisis is. Isn't that great? And by the way, today at antiwar.com is a piece by Phil Giraldi reviewing Gareth Porter's new book. The title of the article is Targeting Iran. Gareth Porter's new book tells all by Phil Giraldi. Go to my Twitter feed at Scott Horton Show and I link to it, or just look right there at the top of the page at antiwar.com. Targeting Iran. And that's Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer and he's got a great review of Gareth's book right there. And then also today at also today at the American Conservative Magazine, there's an interview. I need to quit hitting my pen on the table. I bet that sounds bad in your ear, right? In the American Conservative Magazine, there is an interview with Gareth by the great Kelly Vlahos, who also writes for antiwar.com and for the American Conservative Magazine. And that's really good, too. And so, geez, you know, if you're not going to read Gareth's book, at least go and read these reviews of it. And if you can think of somebody who knows somebody who ought to really get a hand on this thing and read it, then, I don't know, maybe try a little to see if you can make that happen. You know, I don't know. If I had a bunch of money, I would buy boxes full of these things, and then I would just put them all in the mail to libraries. Say, a free gift of a book to you. Here. Do people still go to libraries? I think so. If it was up to me, I'd have Google Books put that whole thing online right now, too. I mean, what's that going to cost him money? No way. That's just going to help get it around. I should bring that up to him. Hey, Gareth, what about telling Google, please, take my book? Right? Isn't that a good idea, chat room guys? What do you think? Because they put books on there. Some people fight about it. But it seems like a good idea to me. Okay. So that's all I got to say about that. I don't want to talk about Ukraine. I guess good. First, I'm going to talk about the NSA thing real quick. Isn't there a brand new NSA story? Yeah. Right here. The NSA performed warrantless searches on Americans' calls and emails. They use their back door to search Americans' communications, and this is about the PRISM and Upstream programs, where any of the information that they collected, incidental to collecting information on a foreigner, who doesn't necessarily have to be doing anything wrong, just be a foreigner, anything that they picked up incidental to that, yes, now they have confirmed in a letter to Senator Wyden that, yes, they do go back through that. Once it's through the loophole, then all bets are off and they can do whatever they want. And they hadn't confirmed that detail before, but now they've come forward with that. And that's a story by Spencer Ackerman in The Guardian today. NSA performed warrantless searches on Americans' calls and emails. Clapper. And then Glenn Greenwald has a piece at The Intercept which is not breaking news. It's a blog entry opinion piece, but it's good. NSA blows its own top secret program in order to propagandize. And of course, you know, he has a personal dog in this fight about how they've been trying literally to criminalize whistleblowing, and they've been succeeding in prosecuting whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, and they've been threatening Greenwald. Not so much Gelman, who writes for the Post, but they've been threatening Greenwald with some kind of prosecution for doing this NSA journalism. And yet, here's Keith Alexander, the outgoing head of the NSA, bragging to his loyal sock puppet, Ken Delanian, at the LA Times, and saying, yeah, in Iraq, under my leadership, we got to where we could accept all of every Iraqi email, text message, and phone location signal in real time. Oh, this is not Keith Alexander. It's one of his underlings. John Inglis says so to the LA Times. And so this is, you know, in the context of bragging about their accomplishments. And, oh boy, we couldn't have won that war. Is that what they're calling it? If it hadn't been for this. And meanwhile, so as Greenwald points out, the Washington Post published this thing about the Mystic program where they were bragging about getting all recording all of the phone calls in a country which was assumed to be Pakistan, but we didn't know. I don't know who assumed it was Pakistan. Some people did. Could have been anybody. And then that was old news. That was those documents were from years ago, and it said in the documents they were working on duplicating the capability all over the world from there. And this was the highest of treason, right? When Edward Snowden said it and leaked the document and gave it to Barton Gellman in the Washington Post, as official as it gets in the whole wide world, who decided to publish this. Oh, you know, never mind the Post, but it's treason of Snowden to leak that to, I don't know, Greenwald. they don't want to pick a fight with the Washington Post. I guess they're afraid they'll lose, but I don't think they got that much to worry about, honestly. Certainly the opinion pages are on their side. But anyway, so Greenwald's just pointing out the hypocrisy here, where they will leak the highest level of classified information about their capabilities in order to make themselves look good. And nobody calls it treason, and no one says the guy from the LA Times should be strung up, like they say about Greenwald and all that. Oh, and also there was a story about these people were beating their kid and they ran off to a motel, and the cops just traced their cell phone signal, no problem, went and found them. Get ready for hearing stories like that all the time from now on. Cops just traced the cell phone signal. Your local sheriff will be able to do it out of his car console in no time. Maybe already can. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Hey, you should help support the show. How about advertising on it? I'll advertise your stuff for not much money. That'd be great. Send me an email, scott@scotthorton.org. Or you can just send me whatever quantity of money you want. PayPal's the easiest, but you could also use Google Wallet or whatever. All that information is there at scotthorton.org/donate. And, you know, what's really helpful is all the people who have signed up for 10, 15, 20 bucks and more, even some people have, for the monthly subscriptions. That sure helps. That sure helps fill in the gap between surviving doing this or not. So I sure appreciate that on behalf of all those people who do that. And all the single donations and all the monthly subscriptions and all that stuff. It sure is great. And I accept bitcoins too. Just go to scotthorton.org /donate, and I got my Bitcoin address down there. Maybe you have a whole bunch of those things, and you just hate them, and you want to get rid of them all. Well, I guess I'll take them off your hands if that's how you are about it. Send them here. All right. So that's all I got to say about that. I'm not going all NPR on you or anything, but just so you know, I like money. Okay, now, so here's this other thing. Remember earlier on the show we were talking about how Dick Cheney had these people tortured into implicating Saddam Hussein? You can go read that again. Jonathan Landay at McClatchy Newspapers has got, I mean, there are other sources too, as I said before, but that's really all you need to go and look at right there. He'll prove it for you. And anyway, I just thought it was hilarious. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to go through for the good sound bites or anything because the whole thing is like half an hour long and I just didn't have time to prepare today to go through it. But they have the audio and it's Dick Cheney talking about bombing Iran. And we don't need to deal with Iran, we just need to bomb them. And he's talking to a bunch of donors, and this was at the Sheldon Adelson conference thing, where Chris Christie made his big gaffe of calling the occupied territories the occupied territories that we talked about on the show yesterday. Went and cried and begged forgiveness for that. But now, so Cheney talks about a conversation in 2007 with General Amos Yadlin, who was, it says here, helped fly the Osirak mission in 1981, which, of course, as we've talked about on the show a million times, actually just drove the Iraqi nuclear program underground. It had been an IAEA safeguarded facility, a peaceful nuclear program, until they bombed it. And at that point, Hussein decided, well, he was going to proceed with the nuclear technology, but what he wanted was weapons-grade uranium, and then the Israelis would never bomb him again, he thought. And by the time of the first Gulf War, he was on his way. He was still quite a ways away from having a bomb worth, even a single bomb worth of weapons-grade uranium, but he was working on the project. I think they had barely any, honestly. But still, pretty much backfired if you look at it that way. And nobody knew about the secret program until the aftermath of the war. They found it. They had bombed it, not knowing what they were bombing. And anyway, so he was talking with Dick Cheney, and Cheney says he looked across the table over dinner and he said, "Two down, one to go." I knew exactly what he meant. Wait, who was the two? I get you about Iraq. Anyway, so everybody in the crowd loved it. Sorry I blew the context for you there. But then here's the other thing, man. This is where I like it, where he's attacking Barack Obama. And, you know, good, I hate Barack Obama too. Everyone attack him. But that's not the point. The point is that what Cheney says, this guy's, I don't know, man. He's kind of a cartoon character in a way. You would think, I would think, sorry to put that on you, I would think that somebody with that much power has to be a little bit thoughtful, but I guess that's not how to get powers, by being thoughtful. I don't know. I mean, is he a damned fool? Is that the thing of it? I mean, I know he's a mean son of a bitch. Nobody really argues about that, right? But... and I think he's a big coward, too. I think when the Secret Service went and, you know, dragged him down to the basement on the 9/11 when they thought the fourth plane was coming for the White House and all that, you know, I could see him crapping his pants and getting all crazy. 1% doctrine. But I think it's possible that actually the guy's really a dimwit, too. He sort of, you know, he could be a Fox TV host, maybe. Not charismatic enough for that. Anyway, sorry. Point is, here's the quote. The bottom line is, the United States' position in the Middle East is worse than at any time in my lifetime. It's reached the point where Israel and Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan are closer to one another, imagine that, than any of them is to us. Nobody who's been our friend in the past any longer has any sense of trust in we'll keep our commitments, that we'll be there in a crisis when they need us. On the other hand, none of our adversaries need fear us. Noting that the chief responsibility of a president is to protect the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, No, it's not. It's to faithfully execute the law. But anyway, Cheney claimed that today that charge is, quote, not being pursued in any kind of coherent manner. Well, that much I can give him credit for there. Then he goes on to attack Rand Paul for believing the U.S. can turn its back on that part of the world and calls Rand Paul an isolationist. So let me dispense with that real quick. No amount of sucking up on Rand Paul's part is ever going to make the Republican establishment love him. Not never. There's a whole thing here in Time Magazine, too. GOP hawks worry Rand Paul has too much Ron. Well, who's he gotta kill? How many people does Rand Paul have to kill for them to decide, okay, you can be one of us? Too many. So, you might as well just be good. Instead of being bad on Guantanamo and bad on sanctions against Iran, bad on staying in Afghanistan, bad on 100 other things, you might as well just be good. Because they're never going to let you in anyway. They're never going to let you in, they're never going to let you win anyway. Oh, well, we should have some bases around the world, maybe just not 1,000. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And meanwhile, you might as well be Ron to the bad guys. To the war party. So you might as well be wrong. But that's not even the real point. The real point is Dick Cheney has no idea that the American invasion of Iraq is what completely destabilized everything in the region. First of all, they had to counterfeit money to pay for it all. And the rest, because America has the reserve currency of the planet Earth, that means pretty much everybody is stuck inflating in concert the best they can with the American Federal Reserve, or else it throws off their trade balances too much. So every nation in the region has had to debase their currency. And they all are a bunch of Keynesians who all print money all day for themselves anyway, no matter what. But a big part of this is the American war. The inflation of the Bush Jr. years were a disguise to try to make the Iraq war seem free or even profitable for a little while before it all came crashing down. Well, it hurt the rest of the region, too, where people are already poor, and then when you make their money worthless through inflation, it really hurts, right? When you make $2 a day and all of a sudden your $2 a day is only worth $1 a day. Bread riot. Simple as that. And then the other thing is it made everyone in the region, the population of every state in the region, hate their sock puppet dictatorship, owned lock, stock, and barrel, each and every one of them by the USA, that much more. That it was the Americans who are rampaging across Iraq for 8 years straight, torturing and murdering and exploding and burning people to death. 1 million people died in the civil war that America caused there. Most of them probably killed by the American military, honestly. At least half or so. And then all of the deprivation from there. And then, of course, the Americans, because of what a position they put themselves in, ended up fighting the war, ultimately fighting that civil war for the Shia Arabs in alliance with Iran until they cleansed the capital city, as they call it, the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, and kicked all the Sunni Arabs out and, you know, created really a Shia stan from Baghdad to Basra anyway, and have completely excluded the Sunni Arabs from power in Iraq, which is, of course, why the Sunni insurgency was fighting all that time, because they could see the writing on the wall from the very beginning that that was where they were going, losing their minority dictatorship to the majority. They lost the capital city, too, and so the fight, so that angered and freeked out every government, whether it was Hosni Mubarak, his military regime, or the kings of Arabia, or the Muslim Brotherhood, or anybody else. Everybody's completely freaking out about that. And then, of course, you have the entire Israeli construct that of the Shia Crescent, backed by Iran, and then their new ally in Iraq. They always leave that out because they'd have to admit it's their fault that Iraq is now an ally with Iran and with Syria and with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. The Dawah Party and Hezbollah, of course, go way back. Well, it's true that these are all allied states, but what does their power really amount to? Not much. And as we've seen, we could be friends with the Iranians if we want to. All we got to do is put the nuclear deal, you know, get that done and put that issue to the side. And we can open up relations and befriend our so-called enemies there. The Iranians, as far back as 2003, were willing to negotiate even their support for Hezbollah and for Hamas. And so we'll put pressure on these groups to simply disarm and become political parties and join up their national governments and stop being little mini states anymore. And all of this is up on the table for negotiation if we want to negotiate. It's Dick Cheney who has refused to negotiate with Iran all the time. It was Dick Cheney that made sure that not only did he reject the golden Iranian offer of 2003, but that the Swiss ambassador was screamed at for daring to bring the peace offer to Washington, D.C. So what I'm saying is, it was Dick Cheney that ruined everything with his war in Iraq. Now, it's true that Obama is outright backing the Mujahideen and has been for 3 years in a row now backing the Mujahideen in Syria. But ask Dick Cheney. And his problem is that he hasn't done so enough, that he's left Assad in power this whole time. Not that he's backing the Al-Qaeda suicide bombers, which you might think is the real problem. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Introducing Robert Blumen. He's actually the first Austrian economist. And therefore the first person to call the housing bubble in the last decade there. Him and Mark Thornton and them over at Mises.org, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, where they study Austrian economics. And Robert's got a great new article there. That's actually a talk that he gave, the transcript or the speech that he wrote for a conference on Austrian economics that was held back in February. It's called Say's Law and the Permanent Recession. Very interesting stuff. Welcome to the show, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm great, Scott.
Well, good, good. Very happy to talk with you again. Who was J.B. Say? What was his law, and why would anybody obey it?
Say was a French economist from the 18th century. When we talk about laws in economics, we're talking about regular patterns of the way things work in the real world that economists observed and gave them names. Say observed that the way that people demand something in the market is by supplying something else, that every demand is accomplished by supply, and every supply is a way of demanding something, and that's what we remember him for.
All right. And now, so what's really the significance of this? I mean, it makes sense to me, logically speaking, that the reason people show up at work is so that they can take care of their wants and needs and that kind of thing, right? But so what? Isn't that obvious? What's the big deal?
You'd be surprised, Scott. There was a tremendous amount of debate over whether this was true or not. About 50 years after Say published his book, there was a great debate between two British economists, Thomas Malthus and David Ricardo, which we know as the general glut debate. The idea of a general glut is that somehow the market has produced too much of everything, and for some reason markets cannot clear. So we're stuck with this surplus of every possible good. Malthus thought this was a great danger that the market economy could go down that path, mm-hmm. but Ricardo used Say's law to show that this could not possibly characterize anything that could happen in the real world. Ricardo pointed out that there cannot be a glut of everything in general, because everything in general that's demanded and everything in general that's supplied are the same thing. So macroeconomically, there is a balance between supply and demand. And this, again, has proved to be very significant because of the rise of Keynes and Keynesian economics, which is based on the same old argument that Ricardo destroyed back in the 1800s.
All right, now, well, I guess if it was Say versus Ricardo, then that would have been before Karl Marx, but I've read some Karl Marx where he says, just look at these idiotic capitalists and their idiotic free market system where they produce so much of something that we right now have warehouses full of finished goods and lines full of unemployed and hungry people, and because these capitalists, they can't see far enough ahead, they overproduce everything they have for short-term profit, that they end up driving their own prices down through the floor and driving themselves right out of business. So, and they do it in these big cycles, and I think that's why we need a communist state to prevent that kind of thing.
Scott, you've heard the term the dismal science to describe the field of economics. The original meaning of that was, I think it was from Malthus, and he thought we would all get poorer and poorer over time. And I think economics is a dismal science because the same bad ideas keep getting revived, no matter how many times they've been debunked.
Right.
This type of theory, they're either called overproduction or underconsumption theories, which are two different angles on the same thing. Both of them are saying that supply and demand at an aggregate level can get out of balance. If you think that the purchasing power of labor as a whole cannot keep up with production, then you would call it underconsumption. If you're seeing it more from the good side of too many goods getting produced and not enough buying power, then that would be more of an overproduction angle on it. Marx is one example, Malthus, Keynes. It's all the same idea, and it's all wrong because of Say's law.
All right, well, so does that make you a Chicago school supply-side monetarist, like a Reaganite kind of a thing then? If you say that what we don't need is to stimulate demand, that's not the problem, that there's a lack of demand. The problem is a lack of production, right? That makes you a supply-sider, doesn't it, Robert?
I first started hearing the word supply-side back in the 80s, around the time that Reagan ran for president. I think what they were trying to do with that term, it was a really small group of people, and I don't know you could even call them a school because there were only ever a few. There was Laffer, Wininsky, and Gilder are the names I remember. And they were trying to call attention to this exact issue, that economics through Keynes have been taken over by the underconsumptionists. Keynesian economics is based on the idea that demand can be a problem, that the economy can get stuck in a place where there's not enough demand, not purchasing power, and the government has to come in and create phony demand through stimulus or other Keynesian measures to bring supply and demand back into balance. But according to Say's law, demand comes about through producing things and supplying them to market. So the real problem is not how do we generate fake demand to get people spending again. It's how do we get people producing again. The problem during a recession is there are people who are not producing. And I think the label supply side, they were intending to call attention to exactly that point, which I agree with them.
Right. Well, but now, so what we do have, though, I don't know, I guess you say this is not a general glut. This is something else when we have this so-called cluster of errors, the unsustainable boom theory, right? The Austrian theory of the so-called business cycle. That says that you get a whole lot of people overproducing at least something, houses or derivatives of housing mortgages, things like that, no?
Yes. Everybody who observes economic life would acknowledge that there are such things as we call recessions or depressions. Keynes, in his book, started out with a critique of Say's law. Keynes said the problem with Say's law and the thinkers of that era is it only works when you're not in a recession. If you have any idle capacity, unemployment, then Say's law is no longer true. And Keynes said, I've found a loophole or a hole in the reasoning of classical economists. They failed to consider this case. But that's complete nonsense. There's an excellent book by Australian economist Stephen Cates about Say's law. He goes through the writing of the economists of that era, and he shows that they were absolutely aware of such thing as recession and depression. Now, as I've been saying, we cannot explain recessions or depressions by a general underconsumption or general overproduction. The classical economists and the Austrian economists all offer a different type of theory for recessions, which is the wrong mix of goods and services got produced. You had too much of some things and not enough of other things. And the things you had too much of, those particular things maybe cannot be sold at a price which will cover the cost of producing them. So you get some producers, the ones who produced the wrong things, well, they may take a loss and they may have to lay off their workers. And that is what we see happening during a recession. It's particular problems of proportionality of some things and other things, and not a general problem of demand in general or supply in general.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, but now, so whenever there is a recession, like this one or the last one or the one before that, they always say, well, we've got to stimulate to pick that demand back up. And we can't just let, they might even concede some of the time, I think, Robert, that, you know, there are a lot of bad debts that do have to be liquidated, but, you know, let's give it a soft landing. We've got to inflate. We'll make sure that the banks stay whole, because if they fall, you know, in other words, bail them out, because if they fall, then that'll just be, you know, disruptive to the whole economy. And after all, I think you even quote in here this kind of reversal of Say's law, where the unemployed stop demanding. If they don't have anything to bring to market, you know, supplies wise, then they don't have the ability to demand either. And then what ends up happening is you have, you know, good businesses that otherwise, not even in artificial boom, but just in regular times, would be a sound business. Well, they end up being brought down by the fact that other businesses and other people around them are going out of business. I learned about this in junior college, for why we needed the New Deal so bad, was because we were in a deflationary spiral where everybody in town is going bankrupt. And the more bankrupt everybody goes, the less ability anybody has to get back to work again. And so at this point, thank God the Democrats came and stopped those prices from falling any lower.
Yeah, Scott, that is definitely the reflex, and they do use the Great Depression as the case to back that up. The problem with those measures is they don't address the true cause. It is true that you get people unemployed, businesses fail, but what stimulus is trying to do is it's trying to reinflate the old production patterns, producing the wrong things in the wrong proportions. And what's wrong about those production patterns is they're inherently losing money. And losing money in a capitalist economy means that you consumed more economic value than what you produced at the end of the day. So you can't have an entire economic system based on money losing. Then you'd have communism. You'd have there was a great article on the Mises website this week about one of the communist countries, I think it was, might have been Yugoslavia, which the author shows that the entire economy required billions of dollars a year of increased foreign debts every year just to stay even. The entire system was based on destroying economic value faster than it can be produced. And that's not a sustainable system, because it depends on somebody else bailing you out. To get back to a sustainable system where the economy can grow on its own two feet, you need a reorganization of production and of prices so that the entrepreneurs start producing things that people do want in the proportions they want them, at costs which are lower than the prices they can charge for them. And the wages and the profits that are earned under those conditions, well, that becomes the true demand, which constitutes, true supply, which constitutes the demand for other goods. And that's a sustainable process. The only way to get there is to allow the market to work, to allow prices to find their own level. And that can only happen if you go through the recession.
Okay, but here's the thing. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not really a Democrat. I just play one in radio interviews like this sometimes. I try. And this is what the conservative Republicans say, too, is that, well, for example, we had to prop up the banks and keep them from failing in the last recession, because even if it takes much longer, and for that matter, pass all the stimulus and all of that too, because even if it takes much longer for prices to find, you know, anything like a accurate reading in the market. It may take longer, but they will eventually find where they belong. Eventually, we will have growth again, but we won't have let it fall so far. And after all, we just didn't have a Great Depression. We had a pretty bad recession. There was a lot of wealth destroyed, but compared to the 1930s, it's not like a lot of Americans have starved to death over the last, 6 years or 5 or 6 years, whatever it is. So they saved the day, right? Ben Bernanke, with his QE and all of that, they provided a cushion. So the fall maybe takes a lot longer, and then it's a lot harder to get up from the fall, too, because of how mushy the floor is, maybe, if my metaphor can stand. But at least you didn't break your skull when you hit the bottom, falling so far down that then you have, again, that kind of deflationary spiral where good businesses also cease to exist.
I've heard them say approximately 1 million times that through the actions of the Fed and the heroic Ben Bernanke, they prevented another Great Depression. This is a totally counterfactual, hypothetical claim for which there is absolutely no way to know whether that's true or not. But in order to say something like that, you need to have a theory or a point of view about what caused the Great Depression so that you can say we intervened, we stopped the cause, and therefore we prevented another depression.
Well, would it be possible, let me ask you this, hypothetically speaking, would it be possible for someone to be half an Austrian and say, you know what, the Federal Reserve's low interest rates and easy money policy and the Congress's, intervention in the economy, funneling money into the housing market and all that. You guys are right about that. The unsustainable boom, it's got to be the answer of what caused the crash. However, now I leave Austrianism behind. Now I'm a Democrat. We still got to, even after we accept all your reasoning for the cause, we still have to prevent the collapse from going as low as it could by cushioning the fall. Is it possible to make that argument? Is that consistent at all, or could it be?
I think somebody could make that argument.
I just tried.
Yeah. If you think that you can identify the boundary between when all the bad businesses are done failing and now we're starting to get into the good businesses, if you could do that and you could somehow perfectly bail out the good businesses and let the bad ones fail, it seems pretty hard for me to do. It's kind of like the same problem of centrally planning an economy where the central planners don't really have that kind of knowledge to distinguish. And through the course of experience, people's preference change. Something that used to be a good business goes out of style. So what's a good or a bad business isn't really a clear way of knowing that other than letting the market decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can see right now what seemed to me, completely an amateur here, but just looking at CNBC from time to time, it seems like we have terrible distortions in the housing market already where it's just like 2005, or I don't know, what year you'd make the analogy to there, but we're back into artificially high housing prices, complete with all the reality TV shows about how you can become a millionaire by flipping them all day. And at the same time, there are, I don't know how many millions of houses that are sitting empty, and we also have things that, I'm sure this existed to a certain degree before, I don't know, but I've read about certain auctions where the banks are selling off, high numbers of properties that they foreclosed on to only the largest corporations are invited to the auction to invest. And you end up having these new banks and new holding companies that now own thousands or tens of thousands of rental houses that they buy very cheap after they're foreclosed on. The families are kicked out of them. They get the bargain and buy them up. And so this is all the kind of thing where I don't know exactly how it would be in the free market, but we can see this kind of thing is going on in a not free market right in front of our eyes.
Scott, a lot of the attention in business cycle thinking is based on labor markets. People are concerned about the unemployed people and earning their wages. But a bigger chunk of the economy are capital markets, the prices of capital goods, capital assets, and a lot of those are equally or more inflated during the bubble. We had a bubble in stock prices in the 90s and then in house prices in the 2000s. And part of the whole reorganization of production into a profitable, self-sustaining system involves the repricing of capital goods and assets. But the policymakers, those same ones who believe they prevented another Great Depression, they're deathly afraid of letting capital markets clear, partly because they think that by popping up the price of capital goods, they're creating real wealth, partly because they want people to feel wealthy so they will consume more, and partly David Stockman really goes into this in depth in his book. We've come to a point in America where no one who is politically well-connected is ever in danger of losing even $1 on anything anymore because there will be a bailout, and it's cronyism. It's about keeping those people who are well-connected from ever losing money.
Yeah, at that point, the national government system becomes basically just the teeth of a self-consuming cannibal. You know, it's not sustainable for the long term, but I could see why it makes great sense if you're one of the billionaires, collecting all that tax revenue for yourself. But now, so, all right, what about this then, Robert? I become the anarchist president of America, and I name you the anarchist secretary of the Treasury. What are we going to tell the people of America, the society, that this is the medicine you've got to take? This is how it's going to be, but this is why it's going to be worth it.
I'm not a huge fan of Reagan on many things. You do a great job of covering a lot of bad stuff that happened during the Reagan administration on your show. But I think there is a lesson there. When Reagan came in, the rate of inflation had gotten out of control. Jimmy Carter had appointed Paul Volcker as the Fed chairman. Mm-hmm. And Reagan understood what Volcker was doing, and he tried to sell this to the public. Look, we're going to go through some tough times, but it's necessary. And trust me, when we get past, then things are going to get better. And that, I think, is the only way that you could sell this program to the public. You have to have a conviction that when the price system does its job, that people will get back to producing, earning wages, and their life will be better, and that if that doesn't happen, then we'll be stuck. The leader has to sell that message to the public.
And so then, that means then food stamps and unemployment insurance and this and that kind of thing. You got to be able to recognize both sides of the argument that, you know, people desperately need their unemployment when they're laid off and they've got a family and medical bills and groceries and price inflation at the grocery store and fuel and God knows what. And yet also, yeah, I mean, you are paying them to stay unemployed in a sense too. And that's a perverse incentive and whatever, right? So what about that? What about the weak? Because we're talking about people here. And by the way, I was reminded of this too. Maybe you can mention this if you want. I was thinking about this too when you in your essay where you're talking about Hoover trying so hard to keep prices, wages artificially high, and the same thing that they're trying to do now. We see all this debate over the minimum wage, and there's a part where it seems like economists forget that they're talking about people here. And of course, it makes sense, logically speaking, that if you outlaw hiring somebody for less than a certain amount, that you're basically outlawing a certain segment of the population from working. The other side of that is how unfair it is for a human being to work all day and still not have enough to be able to get by at all, you know, or maybe half as much as they need to get by. So we kind of got to take into account that these are our fellow countrymen and everything here, and we got to keep everybody from starving, right?
I do think there is a fairness point where people see the system is working now in a way to prevent the most connected people from ever losing money. The people who don't have that kind of influence, their well-being doesn't seem to matter. I would try to reform the system by letting the market work for the well-off, and if they own a lot of assets that got inflated, well, they have to take their medicine on the way down. As far as how do I see the position of the least well-off, what is the best way to help those people? Hoover was very concerned about the workers. He decided the best way to help the workers was to keep nominal wages high, he created mass unemployment by doing so and prolonged the depression, retarded economic growth, and set back the fortunes of most people. There were people who did have jobs, and it was a great time if you had income during the Great Depression because everything was so cheap, but that doesn't sound very fair to me either. Final point I want to make is that amount of wages that people make, let's say, forget about recessions. Let's say we're in a country where everyone is employed who wants to be employed, and they're making $500 a year. Why is that? It's because they don't have enough capital there. Capital meaning the tools that make labor more productive. The only way for real wages to grow is people need to produce more. And when they produce more, they can supply more and they can demand more. So we need to look at what kind of policies encourage investment and the creation of more capital, and what kind of policies, like we have in the United States here, many of them discourage saving, discourage investment, and as a consequence, discourage capital formation and get in the way of the growth of real wages, which is how everyone, it's the only way that everyone gets better off.
Right. All right. Now, so to finish up here, let's talk about, you know, if you can list for us some things like you do in your talk here. Again, it's Mises.org, Say's Law and the Permanent Recession, where you talk about the major causes right now of regime uncertainty, other than just the QE and the bailouts that are keeping these prices from clearing and letting the economy get back to square one. Even if they got to create another bubble after that, at least let us get a good solid grounding to start blowing that bubble from, right?
You mentioned regime uncertainty, which I haven't defined that yet, so I'll really quickly define that. It's a term originated by economist Robert Higgs. He meant a degree of uncertainty about property rights, about taxation and the return, or even being able to keep your wealth. If that comes too much into question, then people who have assets and who have the ability to invest will simply not invest because they don't see they'll be able to make any money or hold on to it. Now, Higgs used this concept to explain one of the factors that prolonged the Great Depression. And I'm really borrowing from Higgs. He thinks that we're in a period of regime uncertainty today.
And for what causes?
It's not just one thing. It's the accumulation of regulatory and tax burden, price floors preventing capital markets from clearing, housing price floors preventing the housing market from clearing, Fannie and Freddie being nationalized, Obamacare, which besides the taxation aspect, you remember Nancy Pelosi's statement that we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it?
Yeah.
Now we're finding out what's in it. Every week I read another article about an obscure provision of Obamacare that is going to have huge implications on how medical care is financed and funded. And what's made me realize is if I read one of those a week, we don't know how many of them there are. Obamacare is creating huge uncertainty in labor markets, makes it difficult for employers to understand what the incentives are, and in many cases, they're choosing not to hire because they want the smoke to clear and the dust to settle on Obamacare.
Right, and I mean, even to this day, they keep announcing executive
orders. So that was my commie impression. I hope y'all like it. The whole thing, it's a few minutes longer still. The whole thing will be up there at scotthorton.org/interviews. I think I asked him the same damn question three times. I'm going to cut two of them out, leave his answers. This is Robert Blumen from the Mises Institute. All right, thanks for listening, y'all. See you tomorrow.